The U.S. may be in for a record-setting week in terms of COVID-19 cases and deaths. CNBC did some number crunching using data from Johns Hopkins University. They found that over the past 7 days, America has reported a record-high daily average of more than 196,000 cases. That's up more than 20% from a week before. If the trend continues, it'll likely top 200,000 this week. In terms of deaths over the past week, roughly 2,200 were reported per day on average. That essentially matches the record weekly average set in late April. Just recently, a record 2,900 Americans died in a single day. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar addressed the spike on Fox News Sunday.
We're seeing these surge in cases in the United States, but also in Germany, France, UK, Spain. It's about behavior and cold weather. People are going indoors. They're not minding the 3 W's. They're not wearing their face coverings. We're engaged in indoor behaviors where we let our guard down. We need people to renew their commitment.
The 3 W's there: wear a mask, wash your hands, and watch your distance. The figures come as strict new lockdowns go into effect in California. Meanwhile, many governors have reinstated safety precautions in recent weeks, including halting in-person classes and limiting indoor and outdoor dining at restaurants. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How are you feeling about where the U.S. stands when it comes to COVID? Are you worried about it, not worried about it? What would you like to see policymakers do about it at the federal or state levels? Do you think states need to do full-on lockdowns, or are there particular restrictions you'd like to see in place? Are you planning on getting a COVID vaccine as soon as you're able? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Reed Wilson is a correspondent at The Hill and author of Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. Reed, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, for a long time, we were talking about where the hotspots were in the United States. Is that a meaningful phrase anymore, given how widespread this is? Do we still have hotspots, or are we kind of all a hotspot at this point?
Yeah, it is a hot nation at the moment, and not in a good way. The numbers of cases that began to rise with this third wave that started spreading in the upper Midwest and started really focusing on Wisconsin has now radiated all the way around the country. Even the states that have historically done pretty well in keeping this the infection in check are now seeing rising case counts. Basically, the only place where the outbreak is not completely uncontrolled is Hawaii. And last time I checked, they got about 2,500 miles of water to protect them.
Is there any evidence that this current surge has anything to do with the Thanksgiving holiday? I know we're just 10 days out from it. Things can kind of lag after an event, but I know there's concern about a lot of gatherings on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked that, because I spent this afternoon reporting that very question. And it looks like we're starting to see the beginning of a Thanksgiving surge. And let me tell you why. As I look at a state like Wisconsin, there was actually some progress being made. As I'm looking at week over week case counts, you know, by early November, you were at 32,000. By mid-November, it was up to 48,000. And that was the apex at about November 15th, and we started to see the cases coming down, 46,000 the following week, 32 the following week. But now that fall has plateaued at 32,000 cases. I'm really worried what we're going to start seeing in the next week as more people begin to get sick.
Now,
there are a lot of other states where we the number of and then go up again, or where we saw the cases start to fall off and then go up again a little bit too. So I'm pretty nervous about the next week.
And my worry, Reed, when we saw good numbers in Wisconsin, it was a couple weeks after we had this stretch, a long period of time of, you know, 60, 70 degree weather, weirdly, in the fall, allowing people to get outside, open windows. I mean, can it be something as small as that, a good burst of weather, giving us at least a temporary respite from transmission of the disease?
Well, we would hope so, but it would have to be approximately 2 weeks long to make a meaningful dent in the amount of transmission. And we'd really have to see a huge number of people following all of the recommendations that these health experts have been telling us again and again, hammering into our brains. And you know, frankly, we're in the midst of pandemic fatigue. It's been, 9 months? We're all exhausted. We all want to go outside. We all want to return to some kind of normal. But the fact is, the virus isn't done. Like, the virus doesn't go away just because we're ready to be done with it. We still need to air
break it up a little bit there. Reed Wilson is with us. We're going to reconnect. Reed is a correspondent at The Hill, author of the book Epidemic, Ebola and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. We are talking about what's going on with COVID-19 around the country, what different states are doing or not doing to try to stop the spread of the illness. We'll get in a little bit to vaccines and the road to vaccines in just a bit. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions on the latest news, and what, if anything, you'd like to see at the state level or federal level when it comes to controlling the spread of the illness. Reed, let's talk a little bit about vaccines. That's the hopeful light at the end of the tunnel. What are we seeing when it comes to the prospects for a rollout of vaccines over the coming months?
I think in these dark moments, we should pause and recognize just what an incredible achievement the two main vaccines that are in the pipeline really have been. They came out of nothing. I mean, we didn't know that a novel coronavirus was out there back in January, and they are now on the brink of being rolled out. And these vaccines, I got to say, I spent some time looking into them, are incredible. They're built on a structure called mRNA, the messenger RNA virus, and effectively what they do is they teach your body to look out for the spike protein. If anybody's seen a picture of the coronavirus, you know those little red spikes that come off it. Mm-hmm. Those little spikes are the way that the virus gets into your cell in the first place. So these vaccines teach your body to look for that specific protein and go after it the moment you see it. The really incredible thing about this mRNA technique is that they don't use any live virus. So, in a flu vaccine or something, one in a million people might have an adverse reaction or might get some live virus or something like that. There's no possibility of that in these vaccines. So it's really just a tremendous achievement in science. And if you don't know the names of the people who invented this technique at the National Institutes of Health, you'll know them when they win their Nobel Prize in very short order.
Last week, Robert Redfield, director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, acknowledged the vaccines, but said, in effect, let's not take our foot off the gas now. Here's a listen.
We now begin to turn the corner with the vaccine. But the reality is December and January and February are going to be rough times. I actually believe they're going to be the most difficult time in the public health history of this nation.
Can you talk about that prediction before we really get these vaccines up and running, the difficulties we're going to see over the next few months, Reed?
Right. So we're going to see these difficulties because this is a virus that takes time to manifest itself. It takes a few weeks for somebody, up to 2 weeks, for somebody to show signs of infection once they've gotten the virus. Then if things go badly for them, it's probably another week and a half or 2 weeks before they end up in the hospital. And then it's another week or so, hopefully, if they resolve and get to leave the hospital. But unfortunately, there is a percentage of people who will not come out of the hospital. And that takes time. So basically what we're seeing now, the people who go into the hospital today were infected 2 weeks ago. The people who are on ventilators today were infected probably 3 or 4 weeks ago. So imagine where we are now and extrapolate that into the future. And effectively, we've got a Christmas holiday right around the corner after Thanksgiving when all of us traveled. Well, I didn't travel. I hope nobody else did too. But a lot of people traveled around the country and probably spread the virus that way. And so what we're looking forward to in the holiday season is a record number of people in the hospital, a record number of people being treated for this virus. And because there are so many people who need care in the hospital, there are a lot of hospital systems around the country that are now not admitting patients they would have admitted 2 or 3 months ago when they had more space. So, in a real public health crisis, what ends up happening is more people die because of a virus than from the virus. And so in the case of Ebola in West Africa, the health systems collapsed and people died of cholera and malaria and untreated AIDS and HIV, things that ordinarily would be treated by a hospital system. We all have this assumption that if something happens to us, if we have a stroke or a heart attack or get in a car wreck, that there's going to be a hospital bed to take care of us. That may not be the case in the next few months. And that's what really scares Redfield. That's what really scares the public health experts that I'm talking to around the country. And frankly, it really scares me, too.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Scott is with us in Madison. Scott, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I'm a teacher and a parent in the Madison School District, and I'm just super concerned about the decisions that are being made, not based on science necessarily, but based on, like, public opinion. Like, the parents have been asked several times, like, what do you want to have happen? Do you want to have your kid back in school? That kind of question in the survey, and it's not based on if it's best for the kids, if there's, like, you know, if it's even ready in schools to keep them safe. I mean, what I've seen right now, it's not ready to have the distancing. And so I'm just very concerned that, like, when the numbers are getting higher and higher, they're still considering putting us back in school without necessarily the safety precautions for my kids and the kids I serve. And again, it's just, I just want it to be based on what's best, and science should be what we're looking at. And it shouldn't just be based on what people want. I know your guest said fatigue. Hey, I feel the fatigue too as a parent and a teacher. But to just say, like, I'll put them back in school, the kids are driving me crazy, is insane. Like, we're losing lives. We already lost a life of one of our kids who's 16 years old. I mean, he was in the Madison School District, but we weren't even in school, and he died of COVID. I mean, and it's not just the kids. I'm not as worried about the kids, but, like, if the kids are in school, they're going home to a family, Scott, and that family is going to be spreading it.
Thanks a lot for the call. I want to jump in. Scott hitting on one of the most, I think, contentious parts of government, state, local, district decision-making here, schools open or not.
Yeah, and Scott's wise to be concerned about it from both ends, really. I mean, what one of the things that we're finding is that kids' educational attainment is taking a real hit in virtual learning. There are some of the wealthiest school districts in the country have just completely failed to understand virtual learning, or even the in-person part, if you do it safely, in a way that you could do it safely. We as a nation really didn't do a lot of the prep work in the spring and summer to get us ready for an opening. And as Scott mentioned, like, if you open schools, if you allow people to congregate, it does not matter how safe it's going to be. Somebody's going to get the virus. We have to, as a society, sort of understand what's the risk and trade-off of that. How many people getting sick is it worth reopening schools for? And let me tell you, I got a 4-year-old too, and I'm feeling exactly the same pressure. So I understand. I can only imagine what Scott's going through, worrying about being back in class himself. But of course, I mean, this is there is a trade-off here, and as a society, you know, we decided we wanted to open bars and restaurants before we wanted to open schools.
Scott, thanks for that call. We're taking a look at some of the latest developments in the pandemic nationwide and state by state with Reed Wilson, correspondent at The Hill, author of the book Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about where the U.S. is at in the fight against COVID-19? Are you planning to get vaccinated the first chance that you can? Or are you going to take a wait-and-see approach? What do you think of President-elect Biden's call for Americans to wear masks for 100 days? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're taking a look at some of the latest news on COVID-19, including a surge in cases around the nation, upcoming vaccine distribution, new lockdown orders in California, and more. Reed Wilson is with us, correspondent at The Hill, author of Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on what you'd like to see when it comes to intervention by the state government, vaccine distribution, what should the priority be? Call in at 800-642-1234. Reed, let's talk about what's happening in some states when it comes to prevention measures. California, in particular, seeing some big news there. What's going on?
Yeah, California, the Bay Area, Los Angeles County, and I think San Diego has just joined them in renewing a stay-at-home order, echoing some of the strictest lockdowns of the first wave of the virus. And this is they're basing this on hospitalization metrics. So basically, if X percentage of hospital beds are full, then they lock down to try to stem the flow of the virus so that they can avoid overwhelming the hospital system. This is what everybody's concerned about, that notion of just a health system absolutely collapsing. We've seen some other states starting to open field hospitals, places like Rhode Island and Oklahoma City just opened one of theirs in a tent outside of a hospital in Oklahoma City. So this surge is starting to hit hospitals, and that is what's driving at least the lockdowns in California.
And President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, tested positive for COVID, being treated reportedly at a hospital in Washington. What do we know about his situation?
Well, so he tested positive at some point in the last few days. We don't know when. President Trump tweeted that he had tested positive last night. And within minutes, we figured out that he had been admitted to the Georgetown Medical Center over on the other side of town here. And this is concerning because Rudy Giuliani has been traveling the country making President Trump's case to overturn election results in places where they don't have any realistic ability to do so. He's just in the last couple of days, he's been in Georgia, he's been in Arizona, he's been in Michigan. And the Arizona State Legislature had so many of their members interact with Giuliani in the last couple days that they have now shuttered the state house and the state senate for a week to try to avoid any kind of outbreak among legislators there.
I had mentioned earlier, President-elect Biden said on CNN last week he wants all Americans to mask up as soon as he takes office. Here's a listen to what he had to say.
And I think my inclination, Jake, is on the first day I'm inaugurated to say I'm going to ask the public for 100 days to mask. Just 100 days. To mask, not forever, 100 days. And I think we'll see a significant reduction if we occur that, that occurs with vaccinations and masking to drive down the numbers considerably.
So asking, not saying he will try to have any kind of federal mask mandate, which might be tough to pull out. What's been the reaction to his call there?
Well, I mean, it's a move that a lot of governors have made already, and most about half the states now have mask mandates in effect. Biden's touch, though, has got to be a little softer because he's coming into office at a time when we are riven by political differences in you know, effectively between the Trump fans and Biden fans. There is not a lot of room for common ground. Biden can't be the heavy-handed overarching I don't want to say dictator, but you know, he can't be seen as imposing his will on a whole bunch of people who didn't vote for him. That's not going to be accepted, and that's probably going to drive those voters further away from the appropriate remedies that can solve this virus, or at least reduce transmission significantly. And you know, the studies show he's right. There have been something like a dozen studies on mask wearing and the spread of the coronavirus in just the last 6 or 8 months, and all of them have shown that it has a significant impact in reducing transmission. You can see that just in the bell curves of the case transmissions before and after some state implements a mask rule.
Let's go back to our callers now. Eddie is with us, driving a truck in Wisconsin. Eddie, hi.
Well, hello there.
What do you want to bring up, Eddie?
Well, I wanted to bring up the fact that no one's bringing up school teachers and the vaccinations for them. I believe that that's a very important topic that we need to bring up. No one has brought it up. I think that's They should definitely be one of the people that definitely get it first to open up our school system, for sure.
Eddie, thanks a lot for the call. And Reed, Eddie hitting on one of the next big issues, vaccine priority, who gets what first. Eddie making the case for teachers there. What is the state of the art when figuring out who gets the first rounds of vaccines?
Well, we got to remember that the first rounds of vaccine are not going to be a huge number. They're going to be, you know, 10 million here, 20 million there, and these are two dose vaccines. So whatever number you hear, cut that in half, and that's the number of people who will be served. So pretty much everybody is on the same page that the two highest priority groups are the frontline healthcare workers who are, you know, in the room with COVID patients every day, and seniors, especially those who live in long-term care facilities where these outbreaks are not only have not only spread easily, but also have much higher mortality rates because those are the people who are most susceptible to this virus. And I'll give a little shout out to my city here, Washington, D.C. Teachers are next on the list in the D.C. priority. And I know that a lot of other states are putting teachers really high on that list. So that sort of the secondary who gets it after the frontline workers and those older people in long-term care facilities, that's the debate that's going to happen at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta and in a lot of cities and states across the country. The CDC does the recommending, but it's up to the states to actually implement that and distribute the vaccine based on who what their priorities are. I got to tell you, Rob, you and I, we're essential workers. We could go towards the front as journalists, but I don't think that would go over terribly well.
I can isolate myself pretty well from humanity. I think I should probably be pretty low on the list. I can lock myself in a room and do my job. So that's not so bad. Time for one more caller. Sarah with us in Zion, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Sarah?
Okay. Yeah, I'm down in Illinois, and I'm really hyped up right now because I was just at the grocery store. And people in my town used to take it seriously. They used to have their mask on. And now, employees, it was halfway on, and people's noses were sticking out, and this one employee just didn't even have it on. And it just really, really worries me, because this is going to happen in the near future. People are getting so blasé, I just don't understand it. I just recovered from COVID. I got a friend and died.
Sarah, you're breaking up, and I'm sorry. It sounds like you just had COVID, and I hope you're recovering okay. But Sarah, making the case, read that in our last minute, we're slacking on our efforts to stop COVID just as it's getting really bad again.
Right, and this is the fatigue that we were talking about in the beginning here. This is the light is there at the end of the tunnel. We can get to the end. We just have to make sure that we get through the rest of the tunnel. Mask usage is way up across the country, and it's an easy, easy intervention to stop this virus. We should all just do it, keep our heads down, and get through this last little stretch together.
Sarah, thanks for the call. And Reed, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
We've been talking to Reed Wilson, correspondent at The Hill, author of the book Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. We talked to them about the surge in COVID-19 cases nationwide, vaccine distribution, the CDC, and more.